"Learned everything I know from this breathtaking creature right here," she said, squeezing Grace's biceps. "I swear, Grace, when you walked in, I thought you were one of your daughters. You are positively glowing. You're not pregnant, are you?" At this, Grace hooted as if she'd been goosed. "God, no," she said. The other women at the soiree were all dressed in flowered sundresses and linen shifts. There was an abundance of Jack Rogers sandals and Lily Pulitzer prints. They looked like extras in a Merchant Ivory film. But that was the point. Of all the cocktail parties on Nantucket all summer, this was the most elegant and genteel. "Let's get a drink," Grace said.
"I'll get you one," Benton said. "What would you like?"
"I'll have a Sauvignon Blanc," Grace said. "A Sancerre if they have it." Benton headed off to the bar, and women descended on Grace like buzzards on roadkill. Jody Ruiz, Susan Pendergrast, Monica Del Rey. Monica said,
"You lucky duck, you brought Benton."
"He's dreamy," Jody said.
"And he sure cleans up well," Susan said.
"What happened to Madeline?" Monica asked. "Did the two of you have a falling out?"
"Falling out?"
Grace said. She honestly couldn't remember the last time she and Madeline had even been cross with each other. She's been really busy writing.
"Oh, yes," Jody said. "We've heard."
"So I decided to bring Benton," Grace said. "He's been consulting with me on my garden since last summer."
"We know," Jody said. "We are dying to see your yard."
"We thought you might host the soiree this year," Susan said.
"It's not quite soiree worthy," Grace said. "Though, of course, it was. And then some." Jean had actually asked Grace back in November if she would be willing to host. But even then, Grace had been thinking of a gardening feature, and she hadn't wanted 100 people walking across her grass and terrorizing the chickens.
"Oh, stop," Jody said. "You enjoy keeping it for yourself. Grace's secret garden."
Benton appeared by Grace's side and handed her a flute of champagne.
"They only had Chardonnay," he said, "so I thought you'd prefer this."
Grace accepted the flute and smiled at him.
"I would. Thank you."
"Ladies," Benton said, "thank you for allowing a boor like me into your party. I can see my gender is greatly outnumbered, but I like it that way."
The assembled ladies giggled. Jody said, "Grace was just telling us that you've been consulting with her."
"I'm there every day," Benton said. "It's my pet project."
"It's Benton's design, his brainchild," Grace said. "I take no credit. I am merely a worker bee."
"Have you told them the news?" Benton asked.
"What news?" Monica said.
"Are the two of you running away together?" Susan said.
She put her hand on Benton's arm. "Don't take her. Take me." Benton laughed. He said,
"It's Grace's news to tell."
Grace blinked. The conversation was getting away from her. When Benton had said her yard was his pet project, what did the other women think? Had they thought... And what was that comment about Benton and Grace running away together? Madeline had been right. These women were vipers.
"Your news, Grace?"
Jody prompted. She almost didn't want to tell them. Let them be surprised on July 26th when they opened the newspaper. But Grace couldn't help herself. She said, "My garden is going to be featured in the Boston Globe. It'll be in the Sunday Home and Garden section." There were some gasps and nods, a jealous eye roll from Jody Roos. No surprise there. She was the one who had called Benton dreamy, and she was going through a divorce. She would probably like nothing better than to sink her teeth into Benton's strong shoulder.
"That's great," Susan Prendergast said. "You must be thrilled."
"I heard Eddie hired a publicist," Jody said. "Is that how this came about?"
"It is," Grace admitted. "Esther Fan. She sent out photographs and a full description in a press release, and the Boston Globe was the first to bite." The way she said this made it sound like there might have been more than one publication that wanted to shine its spotlight on Grace's garden.
"I was hoping for Classic Garden," Benton said. "I did a project in Savannah years ago that was featured in that magazine. They do a spectacular job."
"I do love Classic Garden," Susan said.
Grace wondered if she should have waited for Classic Garden to say yes before she agreed to the Boston Globe. That way, Benton would have had his first choice. She sipped her champagne. The other women were looking at her with envy, yes, but also with a certain amount of disdain, or so she suspected. Her husband had hired a publicist, and now Grace's yard would be featured in the Boston Globe. What was it really but a colossal display of vanity? Before Grace could gauge how egregious getting a publicist for her garden might seem to these women, her thoughts were interrupted. "Grace? Hi!" a loud female voice said. "Hi, hi, hi, hi! I can't believe you two are here!" Grace turned to see Sharon Rhodes, otherwise known as Blonde Sharon. Sharon Rhodes was nearly 6 feet tall, and she had aggressively dyed blonde hair. She had a wide mouth with crowded teeth and a big, hearty, infectious laugh, which was her best feature. She was the loudest person in any room and was therefore always the center of attention. Tonight she stood out as usual, in a poppy-red strapless blouse, tight white pants, and 5-inch stiletto heels that were going to decimate Jean Burton's gorgeous lawn. Flats, Grace thought. One wore flats to the sunset soiree for this very reason. "Hi, Sharon," Grace said. She leaned in for an air kiss. "It's nice to see you." Blonde Sharon regarded Benton with undisguised interest. "I don't think we've ever been formally introduced," she said, offering her hand. "I'm Sharon Rhodes." "Nice to meet you, Sharon Rhodes," Benton said, taking her hand. "I've heard about your work, of course," Blonde Sharon said. "And didn't you used to live with Catherine McGovern?" "McGovey," Benton said. "Yes, great girl. We've parted ways, but I hear she's very happy." "In San Diego," Blonde Sharon said. "She taught my children sailing at the yacht club last summer." Blonde Sharon winked at Benton. "I think she was hoping you two would get married." "It didn't work out that way, unfortunately," Benton said. "Wasn't in the cards." Blonde Sharon nodded, then looked between Grace and Benton as if trying to make sense of what she was seeing. "Benton is consulting with me on my garden," Grace said. "He's got the magic touch. You should see my roses." "I would like to see your roses," Blonde Sharon said, "but you never invite me." Grace smiled. She felt like she was the only person left on Earth who cared about manners. God bless her grandmother Sabine and the Sundays Grace spent learning how to properly butter her bread. "You're invited any time," she told Blonde Sharon. Blonde Sharon laughed as if this were the funniest thing she'd ever heard. It was pretty funny. If Blonde Sharon showed up at Grace's house unannounced to take a gander at Grace's roses, Grace would pretend to be down with a migraine. She would be grateful for the massive oak door separating her from Blonde Sharon's curiosity. Her home was a fortress, and Blonde Sharon wasn't welcome. Grace didn't think Blonde Sharon was a bad person. She was just too obvious for Grace. Her clothes were too flashy, her heels too high, her laugh was too loud. Madeline felt the same way. If Madeline were here, they would talk about Blonde Sharon the instant she stepped away. As if reading her mind, Blonde Sharon said, "So, Grace, have you heard about Madeline's new book? I guess Rachel McMahon got to read some of it the other day." "I know she's been hard at work," Grace said. She smiled at Benton. "Shall we repair to the garden?"
"Yes,"
Benton said in his Surrey accent. "Let's repair."
"You should ask Madeline about it," Blonde Sharon sang out.
"I'll do that," Grace agreed. She linked her arm through Benton's. "Good to see you." Grace and Benton strolled along, admiring Jean Burton's beds, all of which were bordered with impatience. "Oh, impatience," Benton whispered. Grace squeezed his arm. She and Benton held the same opinion about impatience, tired and overdone. They walked over to the first koi pond and watched the orange fish swim in lazy circles. Grace felt the same way about koi in ponds as she felt about tigers and lions in cages at the zoo.
"So, McGovey wanted to marry you?" Grace said.
"Oh, I don't know about that," Benton said.
He stared at the surface of the water. "You can tell me," Grace said. "I won't get jealous." This was a lie. Grace was already feeling jealous. The instant Blonde Sharon said the name Catherine McGovern, the hair on her arms stood on end and her heart grew spikes. Grace knew that Benton and McGovey had lived together the previous summer. Grace had even met McGovey once, when she and Eddie and Madeline and Trevor were out to dinner at Le Languedoc. The Panchiks and Llewellyns had been devouring their cheeseburgers and garlic fries at the bistro downstairs when Benton had walked in with a young woman. Grace had remembered feeling extremely interested. She wanted to get a gander at this curiously named woman.
"My girlfriend, McGovey,"
was how Benton had referred to her last summer. McGovey. It was the name of an elf. Or a gremlin. Benton had brought McGovey over to the table and introduced her.
"Everyone, this is McGovey."
McGovey was what people meant when they used the phrase girl next door. Her hair was auburn. She had freckles and glasses with black frames. She wore a white blouse with black embroidery over white pants and black Jack Rogers sandals, toenails painted turquoise. Was she pretty? Grace couldn't decide. She was pretty enough, and she was young. She seemed spirited, gung-ho, ready for anything. She was probably lots of fun to be with. Grace knew only two things about her. She taught sailing at the Nantucket Yacht Club, and she did not care for gardening at all. When Grace had asked how that was working out, Benton said, "Fine, fine. We have different interests, no biggie." Now, of course, Grace and Benton were lovers, and so any mention of McGovey was newly loaded.
"She wanted to get married and have kids," Benton said.
He shrugged. "Can't really blame her. That's what women her age want." "And you didn't want which part?" Grace asked. "You didn't want to get married? Or you didn't want kids?" Grace had never considered the possibility of Benton wanting children. She thought of Jean Burton asking Grace if she was pregnant. Grace was 42 years old. She was the mother of teenagers. She hadn't given any thought to being pregnant in years. She had felt Madeline was nuts to keep trying for another child after 35, after Brick was in middle school. But now she wondered, if things progressed and Grace left Eddie and married Benton, would she consider having another child?
"I don't know, Grace. I guess I didn't want any of it with McGovey," Benton said.
Grace sipped her wine. She and Benton walked slowly around the other koi ponds, and then they followed a flagstone path that led to a hidden koi pond, one nearly encircled by white Annabelle hydrangea bushes.
"Six koi ponds," Benton said gleefully.
There was a stone bench by this pond, and none of the other partygoers had discovered it, so Grace sat. She wanted to finish the conversation.
"Do you want to get married?" Grace asked. "Do you want to have children?"
Benton regarded her and sighed.
"That's a confusing question for me to answer right now."
Grace knew what he meant. The whole topic was fraught. She and Benton were having a love affair, which was hot and immediate, and Grace had thought evanescent. "How do you see things ending?" Madeline had asked. The answer at that time was that Grace had expected the whole thing to pop like a soap bubble. She had expected to wake up one day and feel back to her normal self, in love with her husband and her girls and her chickens. But now that she was deeper into it, now that she was most certainly falling in love, Grace couldn't bear to think of an ending. And so, if not an ending, a future. And if a future, then the answers to these questions were important.
"Forget marriage for a second," she said. "Do you want children?"
"Yes," he said. "I've always wanted children."
Grace sipped her wine. Tears sprang to her eyes for no reason. Despite the complications with Hope's birth, Grace could still have children. But she was old. Benton deserved someone younger. Someone like McGovey. He wiped the tear from her cheek.
"Grace, please, let's not have this conversation here. It's not a good idea."
"Yes, well," Grace said, "I wasn't the one who brought up McGovey."
"I didn't bring her up either," Benton said. "Your friend did."
"God," Grace said, "that woman is not my friend." She stood up from the bench and finished her champagne. She was suddenly angry, though she couldn't say why. She and Benton were having a tete-a-tete as usual, but it had ventured into uncomfortable territory,
and their sensibilities were no longer dovetailing so nicely. Grace should never have exposed their tender new love to the outside world. Benton pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and handed it to Grace so she could dry her tears. "My grandmother would have loved you," Grace said. "You think?" Benton said. He held one of Grace's hands and gazed down at her with that look he had. She thought, "He's going to..." But at that moment, blonde Sharon came clomping down the flagstone path with Jody Ruse in tow.
"Oh, there you are," blonde Sharon said. "We were wondering what became of the two of you."
Jody said, "Are you okay, Grace? Have you been crying?"
"I'm fine," Grace said, sniffing, shoring herself up to smile. "We're going to hit La Grande Table," Benton said. "I'm starving."
"I love the stinky cheese," blonde Sharon said.
As Grace and Benton strolled out of the hidden koi pond, Grace said, "I want to get out of here."
"You read my mind," Benton said. "That woman is stinky cheese."
"They all are," Grace said. Suddenly, Grace felt like Eleanor must have when Grace introduced her to the hen house. Hillary and Dolly had nearly pecked her half to death. Grace found Jean Burton and made their excuses.
"I can't believe you're leaving so soon," Jean Burton said. "I haven't made my speech yet."
"I'll send a check," Grace said, giving Jean a hug. She hated to go, but she couldn't stay another second. As soon as they were out on the street, Benton said, "Where to?" The sun had finally set, and darkness was closing in. "Should we go for a drink?" Grace said.
"We could," Benton said, "or we could drive to the beach."
"That seems risky," Grace said. They climbed into Grace's Range Rover, and Grace started the engine. She didn't want the evening to end. She never wanted it to end, but neither did she want to get caught in a compromising situation. She turned off Fair Street onto Lucretia Mott Lane. The only reasonable thing to do was to take Benton home.
"Stop the car," Benton said.
"What?" Grace said.
"Stop the car."
Grace did as she was told. Her headlights shone down the length of the narrow lane. Nobody was around. Benton got out of the car.
"Where are you going?" Grace said. "Come with me, please. Shut off the headlights."
"I can't just block the road," Grace said.
"Nobody uses this road," Benton said.
Grace switched off the lights and got out of the car. It was dark now, and Lucretia Mott Lane was lined with ancient, leafy trees, trees that had known the Wampanoag Indians and the Quakers and the Wailing Widows. Benton gathered Grace up in his arms and kissed her right in the middle of the street. It was thrilling, but terrifying. She said, "Someone is going to see us."
He said, "I don't care. I don't care who sees us. I love you, Grace. I love you."
She stared at him. Tears stood in her eyes, making everything sharp and clear.
"Yes," she said, "I love you too. I have never loved anyone the way that I love you."
Grace drove Benton home, and when he told her that Donovan and Leslie were off island, seeing Lyle Lovett at the Cape Cod Melody tent, Grace followed him upstairs to his apartment. "How do you see this ending?" She didn't. Love, the way she experienced it with Benton Coe, was dramatic and urgent and all-consuming. It was love in capital letters, bold-faced, underlined. It made what she felt for Eddie seem like some other emotion entirely. She liked Eddie and had been charmed by him. He made her laugh and offered her what she so desperately needed, a way out of her house with her stifling parents and overbearing brothers. Eddie had presented her with an opportunity to create a home and raise children the way she wanted. He had let her be the boss and run the show. He had provided her with every material thing she could ask for. She was grateful to Eddie for that, but she did not love him the way that she loved Benton. When Grace got home, the house was dark and quiet. Everyone was either out or asleep, and she was grateful. She ran right up to her study to call Madeline.
Eddie. Grace went to her little garden club party, and Allegra was out as always, leaving just Eddie and Hope at home. Grace hadn't made any dinner, which was unusual. She was too consumed with her dress and hair and makeup, Eddie supposed. She looked so beautiful that Eddie almost wished he were going with her. But the garden club? No, he'd rather stick his hand in a nest of killer bees. What was he supposed to eat? He could scramble some eggs, he supposed. There were 5 fresh cartons on the counter. But he could do better than eggs, he thought, as Grace drove off in the Range Rover. He knocked on the closed door of Hope's room. She swung the door open.
What?
Are you hungry? Eddie asked. She shrugged. She and Allegra shrugged in exactly the same way. It irritated him. Get dressed up, he said. I'm taking you out for dinner. 30 minutes later, found Eddie and Hope walking up a cobblestone path between 2 garden cottages toward the grand front porch of the summer house. Wafts of good smells came from inside, as well as the sound of the piano and glasses clinking, conversation and laughter. Eddie's spirits lifted. He took Hope's arm. She looked lovely in a white sundress with her hair in a French braid. She looked like a girl, whereas Allegra always looked scarily like a woman. Eddie and Hope were seated at a table by one of the front windows. The summer house had uneven wooden floors and the rustic, genteel feel of a summer house from the 1940s. The piano player favored Cole Porter. Eddie ordered a martini with a twist, and Hope got a Coke. When the drinks came, Eddie raised his glass and said, "Cheers, big ears." Hope said, "This is nice. Thanks, Dad." Eddie nearly teared up. He worked his ass off. He hustled like no one else, and yet the 3 women in his life remained unimpressed. Eddie didn't need a parade, but it was nice to hear a thank you every once in a while, an acknowledgement that he was more than just an ATM. "You're very welcome." Hope ordered the clam chowder and the Caesar salad, and Eddie splurged on the foie gras and the lamb chops. He ordered a good bottle of Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley, and then he leaned back in his chair and he said, "So, what's going on with your sister?"
"I have no idea," Hope said.
"Really?" Eddie said. Hope said, "Please tell me you didn't invite me out to dinner on a recon mission about Allegra. If you want to know about Allegra, Daddy, ask Allegra." "I'm sorry, you're right," Eddie said. "I have you here, and I care about you. What's going on with you?" Hope shrugged. "Do you like your job at the rectory?"
"It's fine."
"Father Declan isn't inappropriate with you, is he?"
"Dad!" Hope said. "Oh, no, please, shut up."
"A father has to ask," Eddie said.
"I like Father Declan," Hope said. "He's smart.
I'm reading John O'Hara's novel, An Appointment in Samarra, and Father Declan said it was one of his favorite books in college." The conversation had just gone over Eddie's head. He liked to tell people he hadn't read a book since Dune in the 10th grade, but he hadn't even read Dune all the way through. The last book Eddie had finished was Stuart Little. "Is it a Catholic novel?" Eddie asked.
"No," Hope said.
"Father Declan is a priest, Dad, but he's also a person. Not everything he does has to be Catholic."
"I know," Eddie said.
He dug into his foie gras. He loved foie gras, but Grace wouldn't let him order it. She didn't approve of the way they force-fed the geese. As a raiser of chickens, she was offended by any type of fowl abuse. But Grace wasn't here now. She was at a garden party. "I wonder if Mom is having fun at her garden party," he said. Hope said, "Don't you think it's weird that she took Benton as her date?"
"She took who?"
"Benton Coe, the gardening guy."
"Oh, that's right," Eddie said. "She told me, but I forgot."
"Don't you think it's weird?" Hope said. Did Eddie think it was weird? Well, it made him a little edgy, maybe, that Grace had dolled herself up into such a knockout for an evening with the gardener. But although Benton was as big and tall as a Hun, Eddie didn't find him particularly threatening. He was a man who dealt with roses and tulips. Eddie didn't think he was gay, but he was definitely emotionally attuned toward the feminine. And this was exactly what Grace needed. She needed someone to talk to about her garden. Grace felt about the garden the way Barbie felt about privacy, and the way Putin felt about Russian supremacy. Eddie had never been particularly passionate about anything except making money and running. But the running had been more of a God-given natural talent, which wasn't quite the same thing.
"No, I don't think it's weird," Eddie said. "Benton is the gardener, and they went to a garden club event. Maybe I'm crazy, but that makes perfect sense to me. You can teach your mother the names of all the flowers."
"Mom already knows the names of the flowers," Hope said.
"Exactly," Eddie said.
He finished the luscious lusciousness that was his foie gras, and then he waved over the waiter to pour his wine. Then a ghastly thought crossed his mind. Maybe Grace had heard the rumor about Eddie and Madeline and had orchestrated this date with Benton Coe in order to get back at him? But no. If Grace had heard the rumor, Eddie would have had a knife to his balls immediately. He didn't want to think about Grace and Benton Coe, and he sure as hell didn't want to think about the rumor about him and Madeline. He just wanted to enjoy dinner with his daughter. It had been so long since he'd been out. Hope was finishing up her molten chocolate lava cake, and Eddie was paying the bill. The lamb chops had cost $46. How had he not noticed that before he ordered them? When the chief of police approached the table.
"Eddie," the chief said.
Eddie jumped out of his chair.
"Chief, how are you?"
The two men shook hands, and Eddie presented Hope. "My daughter, Hope." "Hope? You know Chief Kapanash?" Hope smiled shyly. Whereas Eddie knew Allegra would have been up out of her chair, shaking his hand, eager to impress. But Eddie would not compare.
"You're having a father-daughter dinner?" the chief asked.
"We are," Eddie said. How fortuitous that the chief could witness this moment of excellent parenting. He was not by himself, and not with Madeline or any other woman. He was with his daughter. It was the best PR Eddie could have asked for, and it was happening organically.
"Her mother and sister are out, so we're taking advantage."
"Nice," the chief said. "I'm just about to sit down and have a romantic dinner with my wife." "Good to see you, Eddie."
"Good to see you, chief," Eddie said.
He remained standing until the chief wandered away. The piano player launched into some enchanted evening. Eddie beamed at Hope. She said, "Okay, I'm finished. Can we go?"
"We can go," Eddie said.
He ushered Hope in front of him and walked out of the restaurant, indiscriminately waving to everyone he saw. Hope. A phone call came to the house in the middle of the night. Hope rolled over. She felt sick to her stomach. The food at the summer house had been rich. And when Eddie had gotten up to go to the men's room, Hope had sneaked a sip of his martini just to find out what it tasted like. It had tasted like lemon-flavored lighter fluid. Hope nearly spat it out, but she didn't want to call attention to herself, and so she swallowed it. Alcohol was disgusting. The ringing of the phone stopped. Hope's stomach gurgled. She really hoped she didn't puke. She tried not to think about the martini. It had been so clear and innocuous-looking that Hope had thought it would taste like water. Suddenly, she heard her parents' voices in the hallway. Her mother was hitting what Hope thought of as her hysterical register. She heard them open the door to Allegra's bedroom, which elicited more hysteria from Grace. So, Allegra was still out. Hope checked her phone. It was 3:10. Wow, Hope thought. Their curfew was 11:30. Allegra had shattered her previous broken curfew record of 1:45. Grace started to cry, and Eddie was trying to comfort her, but he started sounding a little shaky himself. And suddenly, Hope wondered if maybe there was something really wrong, like maybe Allegra was hurt, or... Hope made it to her trash can in the nick of time. Oh, God, she thought. The damn martini. Never again. And never again clam chowder or Caesar salad, which was too bad because they were her favorites, but ugh, vomiting ruined everything. She heaved and spat, and then, trembling, she collapsed on her bed until she had a rush of that "thank God I got it out" feeling. Then she managed to stand and open her door. "Dad?"
she said. Mom, what's going on?
Your sister is in trouble, Eddie said. I'm headed to the police station. You go back to bed, please.
What kind of trouble? Hope asked. The police station wasn't good, but it was better than the hospital. Is she hurt?
Not yet, Eddie said. At least not until I get a hold of her.
Oh, boy, Hope thought. Grace said, You're such a good girl, sweetheart. But your sister... Hope didn't want to hear it. She retreated to the safety of her bedroom and closed the door before Grace could finish her sentence. Hope was such a good girl. But Allegra was not. Nope, not at all. She and Ian Coburn had been caught out in Ram's pasture, sitting on the hood of Ian's Camaro in just their underwear, drinking wild turkey and smoking weed. Further search of the car by police turned up a quarter ounce of cocaine, enough to arrest Ian, who was 19. The police officer who found them was Kern Brancato, although it had been the chief of police who had called the house as a courtesy to Eddie. More interesting than what happened to Allegra was how Hope found out about it. At 5:30 in the morning, she was awoken, with a funky mouth and the stench of vomit in her room, by a text from Brick Llewellyn. It said, I saw the photo. Your sister was cheating and you knew and you didn't tell me. And Hope thought, what photo? Hope responded, question mark? Brick texted, Hollis sent me a photo of Allegra and Ian in their underwear sitting on Ian's Camaro. They got caught smoking dope and drinking by our friend Officer Brancato. Ian equals cocaine dealer equals going to jail. As Hope was processing this, there was a knock on her door. Come in, Hope croaked. Allegra tiptoed in, closing and locking the door behind her. She slipped into bed next to Hope. Whoa, Hope said. This kind of physical proximity to her sister was extremely unexpected. Allegra and Hope used to do things like snuggle in bed together and flip each other over in cheerleading moves, but it had been years and years since Allegra had voluntarily touched Hope. Hope thought she might welcome Allegra's return to the bubble of their twinhood, but she merely felt disgusted. A second text came into Hope's phone, and as Allegra shook and wept into Hope's pillow, Hope checked it. There was the picture of Allegra and Ian. Ian was in just a pair of navy blue boxer briefs, with a bottle of wild turkey between his legs. Allegra was in her pale pink bra and panties. For a second, Hope thought she was nude, and she was pinching a joint at her lips. Her eyes were closed on the inhale. This photographic evidence was so damning that Hope immediately deleted it, even while realizing that this didn't make the picture go away. Who had taken it? Hope wondered. Then she realized it must have been Officer Brancato, with his own personal phone. And he texted it to Hollis. This must have been some kind of professional breach of ethics, right? It hardly mattered because, as the old adage went, a picture was worth a thousand words, and all thousand of these words said that Allegra was doing drugs, drinking, and cheating. For the first time in years and years, Hope felt bad for her sister. She patted Allegra's hair and rubbed her back in circles. Sorry, I don't smell that good, Hope said. I puked. I don't care, Allegra said. I probably don't smell like flowers either. True, Hope thought. Marijuana, booze, cigarettes, or as Mrs. Aguiar in the rectory office would say, the odors of hell and damnation. What are you the most upset about? Hope asked. This question was met with an extended bout of tears. Hope continued to rub her sister's bony back. Allegra barely ate. Possibly she was still holding out for that modeling contract, or she was so thin because she snorted cocaine with Ian Coburn off the dashboard of the red Camaro. Nothing, at this point, was beyond the realm of possibility. Ian going to jail? Allegra said. Brick hating my guts? Hollis telling everyone I'm a slut? Kern Brancato busted us. He took a picture. I thought he would be cool about it. I thought he would just let us go. But he was out to prove himself, or whatever, big man on the Nantucket police force. As soon as he got back to his squad car, he texted the picture to Hollis, and Hollis, my own best friend, my soul sister, texted it to the rest of the universe.
Hope tried to think up some words of comfort. Hollis had sent the picture out. She and the rest of Allegra's friends were a gang of backstabbing opportunists.
"Mom and Dad are pissed," Allegra said.
"Dad grounded me."
"Wow," Hope said. Eddie never grounded Allegra, but apparently being called in the middle of the night by the chief of police had done the trick.
"And he took my phone," Allegra said.
"Oh, boy," Hope said.
"Can I use yours, please?" Allegra asked. "I need to text Brick."
"Just call him from the landline," Hope said.
"Let me use your phone."
"No," Hope said. "I'm not comfortable with that."
"Not comfortable?" Allegra said.
"Sorry," Hope said. Allegra's face took on an expression that Hope thought of as standard operating bitch. But then, perhaps realizing that wouldn't get her what she wanted, she dissolved into tears.
"What should I do, Hope?"
"Probably," Hope said, feeling a surge of tenderness for her sister. "You should try and sleep." Later, when Allegra was in fact asleep and snoring softly in Hope's bed, Hope texted Brick. She said, "You should probably forgive her." Eddie was still half asleep when he arrived at the police station to pick up Allegra. The chief had been the one to call Eddie, and when Eddie heard the chief's voice, he turned into quivering jelly. He thought, Barbie was right. He thought, the girls have been caught with Casper Snacks out at 10 Low Beach Road. Eddie wasn't going to lie. When the chief said he was calling because Allegra had been caught drinking in Ram's pasture, Eddie had felt nearly giddy with relief. Then the appropriate emotions caught up with him, and he said,
For God's sake, Ed, you're kidding.
I wish I were, the chief said.
I'm sorry, Eddie. She's at the station. You'll have to go get her.
Eddie said, I guess I took the wrong daughter out for dinner. The chief said, They're teenagers, Eddie. What can you do? The Coburn kids' parents were at the station. The father, a hothead, all up in arms, yelling at the staff officer, the mother blonde and silently uptight. Eddie didn't know either of them well enough to say hello. He would have liked to have told them what a bad influence and corrupting reprobate their son was, but Eddie focused on collecting Allegra and getting her home. Once in the car, Eddie grounded Allegra for the rest of her life. Then he took her phone. He said, Do you know what it feels like to have the chief of police call in the middle of the night? Your mother and I thought you were dead. But no, you're just a druggy booze hound sitting out in public in your underwear with some guy who isn't even your boyfriend. They have names for people like that, Allegra, and they aren't very flattering. Allegra cried, and then she bawled and hiccuped and sounded as if she were having an epileptic seizure. Eddie nearly handed the phone over and told her that everything was going to be okay and that he was just glad she was safe. After all, nobody was perfect, least of all him. But he recognized that one of the reasons Allegra had acted this way was because Eddie and Grace indulged her. It had to stop. When Eddie woke up the next morning, it felt like his heart had been braised in a stew pot overnight. He couldn't move, could not rise or get dressed or brush his teeth or face down a cup of coffee or imagine himself upright behind the wheel of his Cayenne. Even the name of his car inflamed his heart. Why had he ever bought it? Because it was a Porsche? Because he wanted to impress his clients? Because he wanted to give the impression of being hot? He couldn't move from his supine position under the covers. He couldn't rise to relieve his bladder.
Grace,
he moaned. There was no answer. Eddie closed his eyes and prayed for sleep. For the first time in forever, Eddie wasn't going to work. When he awoke at noon, the house was quiet. Where was Grace? Had she come to check on him? There was no note, no glass of ice water, no new bottle of cherry Tums placed thoughtfully on his nightstand. Did she not find it unusual that Eddie had slept until noon? Was she not worried? Miraculously, Eddie found he could stand, although he was shaky. He put on his oldest, softest khaki shorts and his t-shirt from Santos Rubbish Removal, and he crept out into the hallway. It had been so long since he'd been home in the middle of a weekday that he felt like a prowler. The doors to the twins' rooms were closed. Were they still sleeping? Hope had a job at the church rectory. She would most likely be there. But what about Allegra? Had she gotten up to go to her SAT prep course? Or was that over? Eddie couldn't remember. He was a lazy-ass parent. He paid for Allegra's class, but when he remembered to ask her how it was going, he barely listened to her answer. And when the class was over, how did Allegra spend her days? Eddie had a vague idea that she went to the beach with her friends, where he now suspected she smoked weed and drank wild turkey. But that lifestyle was coming to a screaming halt. Eddie should bring Allegra into the office and make her file, but he was afraid she might develop a taste for the business, and he didn't want that. Real estate crapped upon the soul. Allegra was probably asleep, he decided. He should wake her up and make her help Grace with the hens. He stared at her closed bedroom door, considering this, but he was in too much pain for a confrontation. Eddie shuffled down the stairs to the kitchen. Grace had been to the hen house already, probably twice. 7 dozen eggs waited in cartons on the counter, and there were fixings out for lunch. It looked as if Grace were making turkey club sandwiches. Eddie was starving, but he feared eating. He poured himself a cold glass of milk. Through the open kitchen window, he heard Grace crying. Naturally, she would be upset about Allegra. She would be blaming herself. He heard her say, "I'm afraid of her. Isn't that the worst thing you've ever heard? I'm afraid of my own daughter." It wasn't the worst thing Eddie had ever heard. He was a bit afraid of Allegra himself. She was so confident, so in charge of her world, that he sometimes forgot she had been alive for only 16 years. Of course, Eddie wielded slightly more influence over their daughter because he controlled her spending power, but he agreed that Allegra was intimidating. Whoever Grace was talking to murmured a response that Eddie didn't hear. Who was she with? But no sooner did he ask himself this than he realized Grace was confiding in the gardener, Benton Coe. Don't you think it's weird that she took Benton as her date? Eddie stepped out onto the deck. Grace and Benton were having what appeared to be a lovely little lunch, despite Grace's tears. Eddie bristled. While he was at work, toiling and sweating over their finances, Grace was at home picnicking with the person who was supposed to be working for them? If Eddie were lucky enough to be reincarnated, he was coming back as Grace's gardener. "Hey there," Eddie said. Benton was leaning back in his chair with his fingers laced behind his head. He looked a little more at ease at Grace's side than Eddie might have wanted him to, but there didn't appear to be anything untoward going on. It wasn't even like Grace was crying on his shoulder. She had her elbows on the table and was dabbing at her eyes with her lunch napkin. She and Benton were sitting next to each other, but not unreasonably close, and when Eddie stepped out, they didn't seem jumpy or alarmed. It didn't seem like they were hiding anything. Benton got to his feet. "Hey, Eddie," he said. He shook Eddie's hand. "Grace was just telling me about your night." Grace raised her weepy eyes. "How's your heartburn?" "Never been worse," Eddie said. "Can I get you some crackers and butter?" Grace said. Eddie wasn't sure he could manage even that much. But it was embarrassing to be offered nursery food because he couldn't handle stuff like bacon and tomato, or even cucumber sticks, and Grace's buttermilk herb dressing. "I'm fine," he said in a way that made him sound like a pouting child. Grace scooted her chair back and got to her feet. "I'll get the crackers." Benton stood as well. "I should go. I have the lovely Mrs. Allamand waiting for me." "Edith Allamand?" Eddie said. Benton grinned. "The one and only." Edith Allamand lived at 808 Main Street, in a house that made Eddie salivate every time he drove past it. It was, possibly, the finest example of Whaling-era money on Nantucket, aside from the Hadwin House and the Three Bricks. Edith Allamand was about 500 years old, but still cogent and active. She was the kind of woman Grace had described her grandmother Sabine to be, impossibly refined and elegant. Otherwise, Eddie might have knocked on her door and begged her to let him list the house. "Do you think she'll ever sell?" Eddie asked. "Never," Benton said. "She's leaving the house to the Nantucket Historical Association." Eddie's hopes deflated, even though he knew she would do something socially responsible with it, like give it to the historians. "Perfectly good waste of a six-figure commission," Eddie said.
Benton threw his head back and laughed, and Eddie congratulated himself on being able to joke despite his excruciating pain. He liked Benton Co., he decided. Nice guy. And clearly at the top of his professional game, if Edith Allemand trusted him. Benton waved.
Good to see you, Eddie. I'm sorry to hear about Allegra, but this too shall pass.
Oh, I know, Eddie said. Thanks.
Bye, Grace, Benton called out. Hang in there. I'll see you later.
They could just barely hear Grace's voice from inside. Thanks. Bye. Madeline. She was awoken in the morning by a phone call from Trevor.
You have to come home, he said. We have a crisis on our hands.
Madeline didn't know why she felt surprised, but when Trevor showed her the photograph on Brick's phone, she gasped. Allegra was sitting on the hood of Ian Coburn's Camaro, in pale, lacy underwear, and she was pinching a joint to her lips. Her long, dark hair was mussed, and her eyes held a faraway, dazed look. Ian Coburn was also in his underwear, a bottle of whiskey between his legs. It was disgusting, not so much because of what it showed, but because of where it led the imagination.
I guess they've been seeing each other on the sly for months, Trevor said.
Oh, my God, Madeline said. How did you end up with his phone?
He threw it at the wall, Trevor said. There's a hole in the plaster upstairs, but the phone survived.
He minimized the screen so that Allegra and Ian Coburn disappeared.
Life-proof case.
If only there were life-proof cases available for humans, Madeline thought. Even from the kitchen, she could hear the sound of Brick crying. Horrible, broken moans punctuated by shouted profanities. Madeline climbed the stairs and stood outside the closed door. She instantly flashed back to when Brick was a baby. She could never stand to listen to him cry. But hearing him cry as a 16-year-old was far, far worse. His pain was real. His heart was broken. He had believed in a girl. He had loved her, and she had deceived him. She had preferred another. She had carried on behind his back. She had humiliated him. Trevor came quietly up the stairs. It sounded as if Brick were pounding on his mattress. Madeline said,
"What should we do for him?"
"What can we do?" Trevor said. "It's heartbreak. He has to work through it alone, just like the rest of us." Madeline looked into her husband's green eyes. She said, "I am not, I repeat, not having an affair with Eddie Panchik." Trevor said, "I'm glad you're home," and he gathered her up in his arms. Madeline was weak with relief. She squeezed her husband as tightly as she could. Brick cried out,
"Why?"
"Why?" Madeline thought. "We won't get involved," she thought. Brick and Allegra were kids. This was their first time through all these confusing emotions. Allegra had strayed from the path of decent human behavior, but she was hardly the first person to do so. "We won't get involved." They were kids. The house phone rang. The caller ID said it was the Panchik house. Trevor said, "That would be Allegra. She's been calling all morning." "Has she?" Madeline said. "He won't talk to her," Trevor said. "I've just been letting it ring."
"Yes," Madeline thought. "Let it ring.
We won't get involved." But the anger in Madeline was its own beast. No mother should have to listen to her child cry like that. She thought, "You wicked, wicked girl." Madeline picked up the phone.
"Hello?
Madeline?"
It was Grace.
"Hey,"
Madeline said.
"I take it you heard?"
"I heard." "The police called at 3:10, Grace said. "Eddie had to go to the station to get her." Madeline was silent. "We won't get involved." They had made that promise for a reason. But what was it?
Grace said, "There were a couple of seconds when I thought she was dead. Eddie is, oh God, he's just furious."
"He's furious?" Madeline thought.
"He stayed home from work," Grace said.
Well, even Madeline had to admit this was surprising. Eddie went to work every day except for Christmas and Thanksgiving. He went to work on Easter. He went to work on Mother's Day. He went to work on New Year's Day, just in case someone's resolution was to buy a house on Nantucket. But, judging from Madeline's own dealings with Eddie, she gathered there was less going on for Eddie at work than Grace knew. Grace said, "He came downstairs while Benton was here. I knew he was home, so obviously nothing was going on, but it still made me very uncomfortable to have them in the same place." It was the mention of Benton that did it. "Your daughter's behavior was despicable, Grace." "Madeline, I'm sorry." "We all knew," Madeline said, "that night when we came for dinner. Ian Coburn was texting her nonstop, and you and Eddie tolerated it."
"No," Grace said. "Eddie told her to turn her phone off."
"She was flaunting it in Brick's face," Madeline said, "in front of all of us, as if daring us to notice what she was getting away with."
Grace whispered, "I saw her with him."
"What?"
Madeline said.
"They were kissing in the car in the Stop and Shop parking lot," Grace said. "I saw them. But I told myself it wasn't Allegra. I told myself she wouldn't do that."
"What?"
Madeline said.
"How long ago was this?"
10 days, Grace said. 2 weeks? So you knew a week ago and you didn't tell me? And you didn't say anything to Allegra?
I didn't want...
You didn't want what? Madeline said. She carried the telephone into her bedroom and closed the door. You didn't want to face what Allegra was doing to Brick because it's exactly the same thing you're doing to Eddie?
Madeline, in this case, the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree, Madeline said.
Allegra is a cheater, and you, Grace, are a cheater.
There was silence on the other end. Grace, no doubt, stunned by Madeline's words. Madeline couldn't believe she'd said them out loud. But she was caught up in a swirling tornado of anger, not just about Allegra and Ian Coburn and the fact that Grace had apparently known about it, but also about Eddie and the $50,000. Madeline wanted her money back. And while she was at it, there were other things that ate away at Madeline, but that she'd never bothered to bring up, such as Grace's migraines. The whole world was supposed to stop and bow down to Grace's pain once a month, but when Madeline had had her third and worst miscarriage, Grace had attended 5 o'clock Mass rather than come straight to the hospital. Grace later explained that she was a Eucharistic minister and couldn't find a last-minute replacement, and she said she had prayed for Madeline and the soul of the baby. But even so, Madeline had been hurt. Grace was her best friend and should have put everything on hold, especially since Grace alone knew how badly Madeline wanted another baby. And then there was Madeline's suspicion that Grace hadn't actually finished reading her last book, Islandia. Madeline had seen it in Grace's beach bag the previous summer when Grace had announced that she had made it to page 150. And then months later, Madeline saw the book on Grace's front hall table, and the bookmark remained at page 150. Had Grace simply stopped reading? Madeline had been too embarrassed to ask, but she had been pretty sure that her own best friend had never finished her book. This was maybe because Grace's intellect was too lofty, because she had been a French literature major at precious Mount Holyoke and read only things she considered important and worthy. Madeline couldn't remember ever being this angry before.
"You're right," Grace said softly.
"I know I'm right," Madeline screamed, "and I want my money back."
With that, she slammed down the phone and for 1 second felt completely self-righteous. She thought of her novel, B/G. Maybe she wouldn't change any of the details. Maybe she would leave them all just as they were so Grace would know. Trevor knocked on the door.
"Honey, are you okay?" he asked. "Who are you talking to?"
"Grace," Madeline spat out. Then she started to cry. Nantucket. Officer Kern Brancato texted his sister Hollis the picture of Allegra Panchik and Ian Coburn sitting on the hood of Ian's Camaro in their underwear. Underneath the photo, Kern wrote, "Your BFF is in big troubles." Hollis Brancato was no angel. Secretly, she had had her sights set on Ian Coburn. To learn that Allegra was hanging out with him at the same time that she was steadily dating Brick set her off like a fire alarm. She forwarded the photo to Kenzie and Bluto.
"Allegra,"
is a two-timer, and here's the proof. She didn't use the phrase two-timer, however. She used other words, too profane to be repeated. From Kenzie and Bluto, word spread to Hannah, and Hannah felt compelled to tell the person who would be most affected, Brick Llewellyn. And then Hannah told Calgary and Taylor Rook and Parker Mars and the rest of Brick's baseball team so that he might have some brothers in arms. By mid-afternoon on Friday, it was safe to say that every student at Nantucket High School had heard some version of what had happened to Allegra and Ian Coburn, and most of them had seen the photographic evidence. Some people said that Ian Coburn had been cuffed and thrown in jail. Some said he was headed to Walpole. In truth, he had been given a slap on the wrist. The amount of cocaine found in his car was too small to charge him with intent to distribute, but his parents were concerned enough that they had already checked out several drug rehabilitation centers out west. Worlds collided when blonde Sharon took her two ambiguously named children, Sterling and Colby, for their six-month cleaning appointment with Dr. Andy McMahon. While other mothers sat in the waiting room and caught up via People magazine with Blake and Miranda and Kanya and Kim, blonde Sharon hung out in the exam room and chatted with Janice, the hygienist. Janice said, "So, have you been out lately, Sharon?" And Sharon said, "A few nights ago I went to the sunset soiree for the Nantucket Garden Club." Janice mentally tuned Sharon out as she scraped away at the plaque on Colby's teeth with a vigor that made Colby wriggle. Colby was only 7. Janice had never seen so much plaque on a 7-year-old, and she was about to tell Sharon so when Sharon said, "Grace Panchik was there with Benton Coe, her gardener." "Really?" Janice said. "Were they together?" "Hard to say," Sharon said. "I don't think officially. But Jody Reese and I found them sitting alone by this little pond, and Grace was crying." Janice wondered if Grace had heard the rumor about Eddie and Madeline King. Maybe she was crying to Benton Coe about that. Janice almost asked blonde Sharon what she thought, but she wasn't sure if blonde Sharon had heard about Eddie and Madeline. Janice sneaked a quick glance at Sharon. She knew a lot. She always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. But maybe not everything. Sharon said, "And then later I heard that Jean Burton thinks Grace is pregnant." Whoa. This news startled Janice so badly that she accidentally poked poor Colby in the gum above her bicuspid, and Colby started to cry. Janice said to Sharon, "Dr. Andy would kill me if he heard us gossiping about the Panchiks. Eddie is our landlord." "Okay, well," blonde Sharon said, "you didn't hear it from me." The only person Janice felt safe repeating blonde Sharon's news to was Dr. Andy himself. Grace and Benton Coe out together at the sunset soiree, Grace crying because she'd discovered she was pregnant. "What?" Dr. Andy said. So few things pierced Andrew McMahon's bubble of serenity, but this had done the trick. And what had Rachel told him recently about Madeline writing some sexy book? Based on her own experiences with Eddie Panchik? On his lunch break, Dr. Andy called Rachel at the offices of Baybury Properties. He said, "Janice told me Grace is having an affair with her gardener." "Oh, yes," Rachel said. "I've heard." "Oh," Dr. Andy said. He felt a bit dejected. "Do you think maybe Madeline's book is about Grace and the gardener, and not herself and Eddie? I mean, didn't you tell me the book was about a woman and her gardener?" "Contractor," Rachel said. She lowered her voice to a whisper. "You just want to let Eddie off the hook because he's your landlord." Dr. Andy admitted to himself that this might be true. He held a delusion that if he kept in Eddie's good graces, Eddie would stop raising the rent. It had gone up twice in the last 18 months. Dr. Andy had considered moving, but few people understood the logistical nightmare that moving a dental office entailed. Rachel said, "The Panchik family is a mess. You do remember what I told you Calgary told me about Allegra?" Dr. Andy made a noncommittal noise. When Rachel started talking about teenage drama, he tuned her out. His last memory of Allegra Panchik was as a pretty, friendly young woman with an impeccable smile and good flossing habits, and he preferred to keep it that way. Eddie. He was sinking. The notice came from the bank, along with a stern phone call from Philip Meyer, loan officer. Numbers 9 and 11, Eagle Wing Lane, were going to be repossessed unless Eddie could come up with the 3 months back mortgage that he owed on each. He was going to lose them. The time had come, said the newfound angler in Eddie, to cut bait. He went through the contacts on his phone, once, twice, three times. Was there anybody else in his circle of acquaintances that he could ask? His buddy Lex from high school was now a slumlord in New Bedford. He was the only other person Eddie thought might have the cash and the interest up his game a little with two high-end projects on Nantucket. But when Eddie called, an automated voice announced that Lex's number was out of service. And so, Glenn Daly it was. Eddie didn't even bother with a phone call. The only way Glenn would realize that Eddie was dead on balls serious was for Eddie to walk right into the office of Baybury Properties. This was exactly what Eddie did. Rachel McMahon, thankfully, was not at her desk. She was probably out trying to solicit clients off the tour buses. Glenn tried not to show his surprise.
Edward, he said, standing up. To what do I owe this honor?
The two men shook hands. Eddie nodded at the chair next to Glenn's desk, which was blessedly separated from the rest of the floor by three cubicle walls.
By all means, Glenn said. Sit.
It was hard to explain why Eddie hated Glenn Daly so much. He was a rotund, affable guy who was losing his hair and who wore slip-on shoes. He had a loud, cheerful voice and always knew who had won what game the night before and where the stock market closed, and he'd always just seen the movie everyone was talking about or just finished the book everyone was reading. The best way for Eddie to describe it was that Glenn had always been Eddie's rival, his adversary, the person he wanted to beat. This was probably born out of their similarities. He and Eddie had started in the Nantucket real estate business at the same time. They had started their own agencies at the same time, and the fact that Glenn was very good at what he did. Glenn had been one of the cocaine abusers back in the 90s. Rumor had it that an entire commission on a house on India Street had gone right up Glenn's nose. And then Glenn went through a high-profile divorce which had reportedly cost him $300,000. Lots of people like to claim that their ex-wife was psycho, but in Glenn's case, it was true. Ashlyn Daly had once chased Glenn through the Stop and Shop with a loaded pistol, and at the time, Eddie had remembered thinking it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But Glenn had proved to be like one of those stupid Weeble toys from Eddie's youth. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down,